Hey guys, it's Michelle.
And Hallie. This is Golf
Mostly.
Season 2.
Woo! And we become woo girls.
Woo girls!
Oh my gosh, you know what? The other day I saw a video of myself. Billy saw a video of me and he was like, "You're a woo girl." And I don't know why, wow. It's just my natural reaction. Oh, it was the Pebble Beach thing that we did, the celebrity hole in one.
You wooed?
Yeah. A couple times.
You did?
Yes. And I don't know why. Oh, wow. I did, but yeah.
I think I'm a woo girl. You know, there's nothing wrong with being a woo girl.
There's nothing wrong with being a woo girl.
Woo it up.
You know, woos are, they're positive. They're uplifting. Yeah. Gets the people going. And I think, honestly, season 2 is worth a woo. So
worth a woo.
Woo! Woo! Exactly. All right. Well,
now we got that out of the way.
Yeah. Now we got our woos out of the way. Man, excited for season 2, Michelle. This is going to be so fun.
I know. It's going to be a lot of fun. We have some great guests coming on.
Very great
guests. First guest we don't know much about, and excited to learn more.
Definitely excited to learn more. He like really wanted to be on, and we're like, okay, fine.
Have his people talk to our people. Yeah. And it worked out.
Exactly. It worked out with his schedule, our schedule. So yeah, very excited to have the one and only David Ledbetter on. This is going to be really fun. He'll be here in a little bit. Michelle, so David, obviously my dad, my golf coach, your golf coach. We could talk about golf coaches and golf instruction for hours, but honestly, I'm curious to know from your point of view, because we'll get it from his point of view, but from your point of view, how did the, you know, coaching relationship with my dad start?
So I got approached by Gary Gilchrist. He flew over to Hawaii. He wanted to recruit me to IMG Academy, and which I went over to go look at IMG Academy. But just my parents and I made a decision that we just didn't want to change my life. I didn't want to move to Florida and only go to school for 2 hours and practice for the rest of the day. That sounded horrible.
That's what
I wanted to go to school.
Awkward, I went there.
Oh yeah, you went too. You did good.
I did go there. Okay. Fine. Look how I turned out. Just fine.
Turned out great.
No, but I understand. Bradenton, Florida, Hawaii. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know. It was a tough sell being like, okay, let's leave Hawaii, go to Bradenton, Florida. And academics was a really big part of my life. And I just never didn't want that to change. My parents just didn't want me to go to a specialized school. They wanted me to go to the same school that I was going to. So anyways, stayed in Hawaii, started taking lessons from Gary Gilchrist, who at the time was head of instruction at IMG Academy. When I turned 13, 14, he handed me over to David. I remember I was at Champions Gate for the first time taking my first lesson, and I was so nervous. I was so scared. David seemed very intimidating. He's like a bit, you know, he's very tall, like super high pants, big hat, you know. I just thought he was going to be really stern and not nice.
Was he late?
Yeah, he's late.
Yeah. Late better.
Late, yeah. But yeah, no, as soon as I met him, I was like, oh my God, this person is amazing. I mean, not only was he so good at teaching golf, I was like, he's like my second dad. He was funny. He cracked jokes. I was like, this is completely opposite of who I thought David Lever was going to be. And since then, Gary kind of handed me over to David, and I took lessons exclusively from your dad.
Wow. And then I was, you know, probably in the shadows being like, oh my God, that's Michelle Wee.
I feel like you weren't interested in golf because your dad would always come up to me and be like, oh my God, you just can't get Hallie to
No,
play
I wasn't
golf.
For a while.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. I mean, he wasn't your golf coach either.
Well, no. And, you know, it's funny because people say, oh, was your dad your coach? And like, when I was younger, yes, obviously. And then when I got in high school and when I went to IMG, okay, how dare you? Do not slander IMG. I mean, anyways, we could do a whole episode of IMG, good Lord. But anyways, when I went to IMG, I got a different coach because I had a very difficult time differentiating between dad and coach. And it was hard for me because here I have this incredible, incredible resources at my fingertips. But ultimately, I was like, I want to take ownership of my own game. I want to have like a normal coach player relationship, someone that I'm not like having dinner with at night, you know, and also like, hey, check my backswing. How's the alignment? Is it all, you know? So, honestly, it was until I was in college. And granted, my dad was still like my coach. He essentially, you know, would just tell my coach what to say and like have my coach send him videos and whatnot. And my coach at the time was good. But anyways, but my dad was still very much involved just without me really like knowing it as much. But when I was in college, that's when I matured a little bit and I was able to sort of differentiate those two and be like, all right, my dad's my dad right now. And in this situation, he is more of my coach. Because when I was in high school, I was like, what do you know? You know? But that's a really hard.
What do you know about golf instruction?
That's a really hard. It's actually really funny. When I talk to some parents, they'll be like, well, you took lessons from your dad, you know, so how can I teach my kid? And I was like, oh, my dad's a little different. I was like, you should probably get your kid lessons from someone else. But in my case, like, I'm not going to take lessons from David Ledbetter. That's just stupid. So I had to mature. And, you know, ultimately in college, I was actually able to listen a little better.
But you said you have to, like, vibe with your coach. I mean, like, vibing with your coach is a big, big part of it. It's not so much, like, the nuts and bolts of golf instruction. You have to, like, be able to understand what they're saying.
Oh, for sure. I feel like finding a good golf instructor is kind of like finding a good therapist, mm-hmm. you know? Like, you and I might go to the same exact therapist, and you're like, I totally connected with him or her. Like, he or she gets me, and you can just open up your soul and fix all your problems. And then there's another therapist you go to, and you're like, I have no clue. Yeah. And it's the same thing with the golf instruction. I remember there was a golf instructor when I was younger, and a lot of my friends took lessons with him, and they got a lot better. And I was like, sir, you might as well be speaking Icelandic. Like, the feelings that you're telling me to have, like, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
So I think it's not like a – yeah, sure, there are 100% good and bad golf instructors, but it's more so finding someone that you vibe with. I mean, thank God I vibe with my dad. That'd be awkward. Awkward. But
no, but I think the thing that separates a good coach from a great coach is the ability to figure out how a player – takes feedback.
Yes, that's
right.
So
because
true.
I feel like, I mean, I've been with your dad for however long it's been, and then I see, you know, your dad teach other girls on the range, and it's so different. You would think that, you know, a coach has one philosophy and then he pushes that philosophy on every student, but it's just really, really cool to see how your dad changes philosophies towards everyone and changes how he teaches everyone. You know, it could be the same thing, but he goes about it very differently.
Oh, yeah. He told me, you know, when he used to work with Faldo, he would say one thing and, like, Faldo was – it wasn't clicking with him. And then my dad said he said the exact same thing but just in a slightly different way, like, described it differently. And then Faldo was like, yes, you know. So I do think that is probably a characteristic of a really good coach, is to see, okay, how does your student – like, what it, you know, to be able to mold your language and the way that you're talking to them and get it across to them is probably, you know, I think that's huge.
Yeah. Like, you know, when I teach Johnny on the range.
How does that go?
You know what? Much better.
It's getting better?
It is, because Johnny, my husband, said I ruined his golf game after we first got married, because I think – I am not a golf coach, and I'm a golf player, and I know the feelings, right, of what to do. I don't know how to explain it, and I'm just like, just do it. Just, like, feel the club doing this. And he's like, what are you talking about? So as we're getting, you know, obviously getting to know each other more, being married, living with each other every day, seeing his golf swing, you know, every time we play, I've now started to realize, okay, this is a feeling that he feels, you know, and it's just like, I'm like, I want to just hit him on the top of his head. Like, why can't you just feel this? He's like, I can't feel my hands at the top of the backswing. And I'm like, how?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because you have been posting more, like, instructional content on your own page, which is so cool to see. But that's one thing I don't think a lot of people really understand. People will ask players to do clinics and give tips. And a lot of times, I mean, at Golf Digest, we'll do instruction stuff. And sometimes the players are like, I don't know how I do it. Yeah. I just do it.
Just do it. And, like, they're like, oh, how do you hit a fade? I'm like, I think fade.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, thank
just
you.
Just think it. And they're like, you know, when I posted a video about hitting a low shot, and I was like, I just honestly just think low. I was like, okay, you got to backtrack. I've gotten a lot better at it, because I've done a lot
muscle,
of clinics.
Though.
It is a muscle they have to, you know, learn to do and practice. And, you know, before, I remember this guy asked me at a clinic, and he's like, oh, I keep slicing the ball. What do I do? I'm like, just aim more left. And he's like, okay.
But it's definitely, I mean, like Colin Murakawa is someone I always really enjoyed doing like instruction stuff with, because that kid is so good at verbalizing, especially short game stuff. Mm. Step one, I do this. Step two, I do this. Whereas like someone else just like, I don't know, open and flick the wrist. You know?
Yeah, like open the club. Yeah.
Soft hands.
Soft hands. Super easy.
Yeah, you guys are making it way too hard. But it's definitely, I mean, even sometimes people will assume just because I'm related to my dad that I can teach golf. Mm. And I'm like, oh, no. Oh, no. I'll make you worse, honestly. Unless you tell me, unless you're someone that can shoots in, like, the mid-80s, 90s, and you have, like, something you're working on. Like, if you're like, check my alignment, no problem, I got you. If you're like, what am I doing wrong? I'm like, I don't even know where to start. Honestly, you do not want me in. Sometimes, honestly, I'll admit it. Sometimes, if I'm out playing with someone I don't really know, I'll sneak, and I feel like I want to help them, but I'll sneak a video on my phone, send it to my dad, and ask, what do I tell them to
do? Oh, my God. That's a dangerous game to play, though, because we did that once. I sent in Johnny swings in the beginning. Like I said, Johnny said I ruined his golf game, so what do you do? He's like, ask David. And then I'm like, okay, fine. I'll send a swing to David, and I asked him, and he sends back the longest text message. I mean, we had to like scroll, like my thumb was hurting, and because he's infamous for that, you know, like you send him a swing video, it's, I would be thorough. Like, yeah, very thorough in text message, very thorough.
Did I ever tell you what I did to him as a joke one time? So, okay, I'm left-handed, but I thought it'd be really funny. So, you know how you can flip videos on a cell phone? So most people, you know, my righty swing is horrible. I'm really not good at it. Most people aren't that good, but I'm really not great. My righty swing, you know, I whiff it, top it anyways. So I swing it righty and I flip the video on the iPhone to lefty. And then I send it to my dad and say, things just aren't clicking. Like, what do you think? Talk about paragraphs he sent back. Literally, he's like, I'll be honest, I've never seen your swing in this position before. And I called him, though. I was like borderline offended. I was like, you actually thought it was my golf swing? I was literally like topped the pitching wedge 20 yards. I was like, Dad, I don't know what's wrong. And he's like, sends me back 3 pages of notes. It was so bad. Oh, but man. I mean, he's a practical jokester, so I was like very happy that I got him.
I think the favorite story that your dad ever told me, I mean, he does do a lot of pranks. Mm. The favorite prank that he's ever told me was at one time he was, he loves sushi, and we all know he loves his ginger.
Oh man, he does.
And you know how there's always ginger and wasabi. Mm-hmm. And the guy that he was eating dinner with never had really sushi before.
I think it was like Faldo or Nick Price. Or
was it really Nick Price or Nick Price?
I think so. Yeah, we'll ask him when he comes. Yeah. But yeah.
Anyways, he told them that, you know, the wasabi was avocado.
Yeah.
And he puts the whole thing on top of the, and it's all wasabi.
Just ate a giant, like a tablespoon of wasabi. Oh, man.
That would be epic if it was Nick Faldo or Nick Price. Yeah, yeah. We'll ask him. One of those two, actually.
Yeah, when he comes in, we'll ask him. But anyways, guys, really hope you enjoyed this interview with world-renowned golf instructor. He's coached players to 26 major championships, and he honestly is the best dad ever. Always made sure I took my vitamins, always made sure my alignment was right. He's just a really good person and has a lot of really cool stories, so we hope you enjoyed this interview. Conquer your green with SoFi, a bank that helps women grow their money with an all-in-one app where you can bank, borrow, and invest. Earn a highly competitive APY, get a personal loan, or even trade stocks and ETFs. SoFi, get your money right. Banking products and loans offered by SoFi Bank, N.A., NMLS 696891. Brokerage and active investing products offered through SoFi Securities, LLC. Member FINRA/SIPC. Welcome, Dad, to the podcast. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks, daughter.
Hey, you have to hold the mic up to your face.
Oh, okay. Sorry. get the rules right here first.
And you're very impressively on time as well.
I know. That was very impressive.
Oh, I'm never late. I mean,
I remember one time I warmed up for 2 hours.
That's what I always say when I'll meet you at 9-ish.
Ish.
Dad, so I had Michelle talk a little bit about when she started working with you. She was came to IMG, decided not to go to IMG. It was a good time. She missed out. But was working with Gary Gilchrist, and then Gary passed her on to you. I'm curious, from your point of view, what was it like working with Michelle at the start? And like, when did you first hear of Michelle, and what were your thoughts?
Well, I'd heard of her obviously beforehand, and I knew she was visiting. There you go. Sorry.
Moving the mic up to the mouth.
She was visiting IMG, and then I'm not sure if she decided or Mum and Dad decided they wanted to come up and see me. We were at Champions Gate, and we just moved in. I think I hadn't been there long anyway, but yeah, and I just remember seeing this about the same height you are now, actually, probably 6 foot or so. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, here's this. I think you were 13 maybe or 14?
Yeah, 13 or 14.
Yeah, something like that. And I just remember saying, this is not normal for somebody to hit the ball like this at 14. To see somebody hit the ball like that, I thought, oh my goodness, hitting these three irons like up in the air, like with an X shaft in it. I'm thinking, what? This is crazy. So you could see the talent there was just incredible. And so it was just. I'd never seen anything like it, to be honest. I still haven't seen anything like it up to this point in time. And, you know, that time, you know, working with, you know, players like Aaron Baddeley and Charles Howell and seeing them at a very young age and still had not seen boy or girl hit the ball like Michelle did at that point. That's why they called her when she played in Hawaii. I mean, I think it was Tom Lehman that called her the Big Wheezy, you know, after Ernie, the Big Easy, because, you know, had this sort of long, I mean, languid swing and just... just powdered out there, so...
Similar to me, right?
Very, very similar. Yeah.
I worked very hard.
But no, she's right-handed. You know, you were left-handed. She's right-handed.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would have been same if we were both
yeah,
right-handed.
Yeah, very, very similar.
Yeah, so no, it was really amazing and just to see some of the distances that she was hitting. I say this, and I mean, obviously, people's bodies change and so on and so forth, but I mean, you were probably longer when you were 15 than you were when you were 25.
100%.
You know, I mean, yeah. I remember some of the holes that in Palm Springs. It just some of the place you hit the ball was just incredible distances. So, you know, 25, you're getting old. You know, I mean,
yeah, it's definitely downward from there. But it's okay. I definitely don't hit the. I mean, I don't even have a 3-iron. I have an 11-wood. I don't even have a 5-iron in my bag now. So yeah, I remember that blade 3-iron that I used to hit.
Yeah, like a knife. You know that Nike blade. Oh. Incredible. Yeah, I mean that was really impressive. I mean, I'd just never seen anything like it. I'd seen obviously some of the greatest ball strikers in the world, and so at that stage you think, I mean, that's why obviously there was all the talk about you playing on the men's tour, because I mean you hit the ball like a guy. I mean, that's just from a ball striking standpoint. So it was you were pretty impressive, I have to say that. Oh,
thank you very much. Well, let's talk about Thanksgiving. Talking about impressive, is Thanksgiving at the Ledbetters. That was my first time that I met Hallie.
Yes.
And I stayed over and we had Thanksgiving together, and that was the most impressive thing I've ever seen. I didn't remember the turkey or anything like that. I just remember there being like 12 people and 13 pies.
We had a lot of pies.
Yeah, we have a lot of pies. Yeah, Hallie has friends that love pies. So so we get a lot of pies in over Thanksgiving. I mean, I think that was a time that we snuck you into the mall without your parents knowing, and so that you went shopping. I think so. I remember that. Yeah.
And then I remember you got mad at me because whatever Michelle bought, I bought. And then you were like, Hallie, you are not Michelle Week. Like, you can't just buy everything, because I didn't have any money, but you had money. So I was like, oh, that's a really cute, like, Juicy Couture thing, Michelle.
No, well, I don't think Michelle had money either, because it was rationed to her, you see.
Yeah, I didn't have money either. I honestly didn't know that I had a card spending limit.
Uh-huh.
On my credit card, like, for the longest time. And then one time I tried to make a purchase, I'm like, your card is declined. I'm like, my card is declined. And I called my bank, and they're like, oh, yeah, you have a $500 spending limit. I'm like, $500? I've never spent more than $500 a month? I'm like, that's laughable now. But, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. But the pies, yeah, that was the first time I ever met you, and we have that funny picture of us standing next to each other. But, yeah, my dad, Michelle and I were just talking about this earlier, Dad. I brought you a green juice because you love green smoothies, and you're very, very healthy. But you... you will eat anything unhealthy as long as it's from the United Kingdom. Anything that's from America is unhealthy.
Cadbury.
No, that's not true.
Yes, it is.
Well, I suppose it is, yeah. You just talk about candy or chocolates or sweets, whatever you want to call them, right? I mean, because I do like English chocolate. You know the difference between English chocolate and American chocolate? Do you know that difference?
No. I'm assuming it's better.
Well, no, the reason is they actually in America, like Hershey's and stuff, they use, they probably call me out and say, no, you're totally wrong, but they use powdered milk, right, where they actually use fresh milk over,
so
the fact is there's more wax in chocolate here than there is overseas because of the heat, you can imagine,
There you go.
Trivia.
Yeah.
Full of useless information.
Dad, so I have to ask, what kind of student was Michelle? What kind of student was I? Was I good? Were we good students?
Let me get to Michelle first because it's going to take a while. she was a really good student, but as she got a little older, she sort of had a mind of her own, So we never were quite sure what methodology she was going to bring. Said, what do you think of this? Okay, so now how come this looks so different to what it did 2 weeks ago? Because I said, there's no point in her doing a book or magazine articles on the swing because by the time it came out, it would have been completely different. So, people are going to say, who is this person now? When you look at when she won the US Open, for instance, it was a completely different golf swing. So I had to sort of adapt and work around it. I wasn't going to say, no, that looks terrible, you can't play like that, now that looks really good, so why don't we just adapt it just a little bit here. Okay, that's good, the thing is, with her talent level, she was able to hit the ball great with any technique, and that's a sign really, of really a talented individual who can say, okay, and she
it's
could
also
change
a mental case.
Well, she could literally change in 5 minutes what other people would take a year to sort of work and grind on. It would take Michelle 5 minutes.
Which is like a
good
blessing and a curse in a way.
It is because it's like, a lot of times if you change that quickly, you can also change that quickly to something else. And then, I think she just drove her mum and dad crazy because it was almost like, okay, so now what do we, okay, we're not quite sure. Okay, Michelle has just woken up. Is she going to have a new swing today?
I would ask myself that too. I would wake up and be like, will I have a different swing today?
some of it was obviously as a result of injuries, and you had to make some adaptations. But it was incredible, really, because, you hit the ball great regardless. And, there were times where, it wasn't as good. But a lot of that, if you think back, it was more during your injury period, when you know, especially with your wrist, right? That was the problem. And I think now, you always learn things as you go on. You don't know at the time. But I think when you were very young, obviously practicing a lot on mats, which I think is a sort of a real detriment to young players because your bodies and bones are still developing, right? So when you're pounding balls off mats, there's going to be that shock wave that comes up through your hands and wrists and shoulders. So I think young players have to be careful when they're doing that because it's not like just hitting off soft turf. And when you were growing up in Hawaii, you hit a lot of balls off mats, So who knows? It's hindsight's 20/20, as they say. But it's interesting. If I was to ask you, what would you change in your career, the way you've approached it? As you got older, you were a lot more. You were focused, but you weren't quite as sort of driven to sort of practice for 10 hours a day like you were when you were younger.
I hit a lot of golf balls. I think what I would change is I would play more, which I started to do as I got older, because I would just beat balls, like you said, on mats for hours and hours and hours, and they weren't even good mats. They were like, mats at Muni's. I'm sure they didn't have mats at IMG Academy. They had grass.
We had nice grass.
That's
where you went wrong.
Probably putt a lot more than hit balls. I think when I was younger, I would hit balls 80% of the time and maybe hit like putts for 30 minutes.
When I first met you, when you were 14, 15, a young teenager, you were a really good putter and you had a fairly conventional stroke.
Yeah.
But you went through some different sort of styles, right?
I had the yips 3 times in my career. Vividly remember them. Yips are a crazy thing because it's literally the same normal motion, right? I mean, putting is so simple. If you think about it, driving a golf ball is so much harder than hitting a putt. But it's like the smallest putt, even like a 6-inch putt, I would literally black out and like feel like I was going to pass out over the ball. And then the tabletop came around and I felt a lot better. I mean, I think I had the yips once after that too. But yeah.
How did the tabletopping come to be? Like, did you just wake up one day or did you see something that inspired you?
Yeah, funny story. So I played with, I forgot who it was. I think it might have been Jiaxin or someone. They were a lot shorter than me and they were also making everything. So I thought to myself, I was like, okay, you know why I'm a bad putter? Because I'm tall. I'm tall and that's why I'm a bad putter. So I'm going to go down lower and be at their height. So I just bent down a little bit lower and I started making everything. So I changed my putting stance in the middle of the round at the Tour Championship in 2013. And I got off the round and the reporters were like, you're a little bit closer to the ball. I'm like, yeah. And they kept making a big deal out of it. And I didn't understand until I saw a picture of myself. And I was like, wow, I'm literally at 90 degrees. I was like, but I'm making everything. I was like, I'm going to keep it. Who cares?
I love it. So you didn't realize that you were, that you looked
no,
like you looked?
No.
It's just, you're like, man, this feels good.
This feels good. I'm like locked in right now. It feels good.
Oh, that's
fun. I had to answer a lot of questions. So did you teach Michelle this? Yeah. I said, hell no. You know, it's like, Jesus. It was like, wow. I mean, it's like, yeah, you could have been a nice side table for a couch or something. I mean, you know, you could have stuck a vase of flowers on you.
I saw something
there
on CB2. Looked exactly.
What was the weirdest swing that I've ever had?
The weirdest swing.
Uh huh. What's the weirdest swing era?
Oh god! I mean, which week? Let me see. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to remember because you did go through quite a few evolutionary changes in the. You know, I remember. You know, one time I said, okay, let's get more natural. I mean, I think it was in Singapore, actually, but I think, come on, let's get a little more natural here and let's get the swing longer because it was getting really short and tight, you know, and it's like, well, that lasted about, I don't know, 10 days maybe, I don't know, before. But, I mean, you know, look, I mean, and you hit the ball great at when you won at Pinehurst, the US Open, but it was a stressful golf swing.
Yeah,
there.
I couldn't. I almost went through a phase where I was like, okay, I'm just going to play the swing and just see how long my body lasts. And then that's it. Because I was like, this feels so good, like game-wise, but so awful on my body that I was just like, at one point I told my parents, I was like, I'm just going to play the swing as long as I can, and then I'm done. But then obviously, like, that never happens. You change your swing because you're like, I want to play longer. And I remember the chicken wing was quite weird. I had a big
chicken wing. Yeah, that was another one, yeah. Yeah. You know, I could have helped you write about 12 books, probably, you know. How to Swing by Michelle Wee, Volume 1.
Volume 2.
Volume 3. Okay, hang on. We're going to go back to Volume 1 now.
Okay, so let's move on to Hallie. How was Hallie as a student?
Well, Hallie didn't start until late, you know, and so she was interesting. I mean, we had various coaches who sort of helped her because I thought it'd be easier rather than me. You know, father daughter is not always easy, as you well know, probably at times. But overall, no, she was good, especially as she got into sort of college golf and what have you. And I mean, because she improved. I mean, when Hallie first started, okay, they had a clinic at Lake Nona, which Annika was conducting. You know, and I don't know how many 20 or 30 young girls there. I think she spent 99% of her time with Hallie trying to get the ball airborne. And then I was saying to Kelly, my wife, you know, Kelly, Hallie's mum, I said, there's just no chance. I mean, because she never played any ball sports. I mean, at all. I mean,
horses.
You rode horses, you know, and so it was like, here we go.
But I showed you.
You did.
And I got it airborne.
Yeah, you did. I remember. It's like, yeah. I remember one of my, you know, my sort of head guy, Sean Hogan, was sort of caddy for her in a high school thing, and he said, you know, this first hole, the dog leg. Dog leg right. Was it dog leg right? I don't know what it was. Dog leg right. And there's a tree right in the corner because she used to have this low sort of duck hook. And so she says, well, how are we gonna handle this hole? Well, she actually, I think, sort of hit it under the branches, sort of left of it, and somehow got it back on the fairway, you know. So probably hooked about
hey, you gotta
40 yards in the air.
You know?
I know. So, yeah, I mean, she really shocked us. And Ultimately became a really nice player. I mean, you know, you really did a good job, Hal. I mean, it's like you surprised the heck out of me.
In spite of it all.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, no. Yeah, you worked hard. You've got, now got a really good swing, and you know, when you go out and play, you play solid golf. So, I mean, yeah, but at least, you know, you tried it as a professional for about 2 weeks, right?
Yeah, and then I was like, never mind. But, hey.
Then you got to go to, was it Morocco?
Morocco, yeah, that was fun. That
Morocco.
Was a good trip.
Yeah.
Dad, let's talk a little bit about, like, Michelle and I, before we had you on, we were talking about how you are very good at changing the way that you say things depending on who you're teaching. Like, I remember you told me when you'd work with Faldo, sometimes you'd say one thing and he'd not quite understand what you're saying, but then you'd say the exact same thing but a different way, and then he'd say, oh, that clicks. And Michelle and I were saying that's what you're really, really good at. And something that, you know, people like to say a lot about you is that you're a technical coach, but that isn't really the case. I feel like all golf coaches have to be technical, right? Like, so when people are saying that you're a technical coach, like, what exactly are they, I guess, accusing you of? And then what would be your answer to that?
Well, you know, obviously people look at certain players. I mean, if you go back in the day, like a Faldo, what have you, and I mean, he's a technical player. So you have to adapt. You have to wear a lot of different hats as a coach in order to get the message across. Because in the end, it's all about communication and being able to teach different people different ways.
And a technical player, as opposed to someone that's a field player, would be someone that likes to think about their golf swing on the course.
Could be. I mean, but they love to work on certain aspects of it. Certainly on when they're practicing.
As opposed to just like hit a fade.
Yeah, I mean, who would be a field player like a Bubba Watson or somebody of that nature, right? Who, you know, the golf is such a mental game as we know, and so I mean, look, there has to be a certain amount of technique. Ultimately, it's the talent that an individual has, like Michelle had this amazing talent, and you try to guide that, and in the end the player determines what they want and how much information that they want. And so, yeah, I've always been called a technical player, a coach. I don't know why. I mean, because if you write books, everybody says, oh, well, you're technical, you know. So I mean, you can't have a 100-page book with one page with print, you know.
Yeah, so. I mean, it's also, you can't write a feel book.
Yeah.
You have to write a book about technique.
I've always liked to have certain, you know, as you know, we worked a lot on drills, right?
Yeah.
Because these drills give you the feel that you want, because you can transfer that technical stuff into feel. That's why I've designed training aids and so on and so forth, because it gives you the feel for what you want to do. Because that's the thing, ultimately, that you got to go out and play with is the feel for it. And so, I mean, and you did a great job at that. You were able to sort of take the stuff in and analyze it to a point where you assimilated it in a way that, you know, you could, you know, you had maybe, sometimes you had one key, sometimes you had two keys, sometimes you didn't think about it at all, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the way the mind works. So, you know, as I say, teaching and coaching today it's a very technical profession, because there's so much technology out there, you know, with all, you know, TrackMan and force plates and everything else is out there. But for certain players, I think, you know, they really sort of get a lot out of that. Other players, it's like, you know, I mean, I always sort of laugh at Dustin Johnson, because he's a very non-technical player and he's got, you know, TrackMan out there. Uh-huh. And I don't think there's anything in it. I think it's just a box. I don't think there's really any there's any mechanics mechanical stuff in there. But no, seriously, what he does is just, it's for distance, you know. He's not overly concerned with, okay, well, the path's 2 degrees from the inside and the face happens to be 3 degrees closed. We need to get this only 1 degree closed. I mean, it's hard to play like that, because in the end, golf, as much as it is somewhat of a science, it's very much an art form. That's why everybody's golf swings at the top level, everybody looks different, right? There's no two swings identical. I mean, they really aren't.
When it comes to, obviously, you see the pros carrying their TrackMan and the GC quads and all that kind of stuff on the range. Let's just talk about your average amateur for a second. If for them, can they do too much with technology? Like, if you have the means to buy a launch monitor, should one just buy a launch monitor?
Well, you got to know what it's telling you, first of all, to understand it. You know, say, oh, well, you've got all these numbers there. Oh, well, that's great, you know, but I'm still hitting a 40-yard slice, you know. But so, I mean, technology tells you the what. It doesn't tell you the why. And I think the best way to use technology really is, like, if you're working on something, so you do a before and then you do an after, And when you're really hitting it well, you've then got your numbers. It's like a, you know, you've got a an outline. Yeah. You've got a gauge where you can then get back to. If you, well, I was really hitting it well when I was, when the club was coming in on this angle, or the angle of attack was such. So that's the best way to use it. I think, you know, you can go crazy by trying to make it perfect all the time. And, you know, you've got all these numbers and everybody's trying to, a lot of people are trying to zero out. It's got to be zero. Well, that's not necessarily the case. It's just, it's how repetitive you are in a golf swing. You know, that's the key. And so it's interesting. I mean, I like the technology side of things, but I still use a lot of instinct. I mean, a lot of people ask me, well, how do you know what to work on if you see a player? Well, I mean, like your swing, for instance, I always, you know, well, normally knew your swing for every time. You know, it was a little different a lot of times, but I mean, you know, I know how you think. I knew how you think. I know the things that have worked in the past and the things you didn't like and the things you did like. So you sort of work, you know, you as a coach, you have to use instinct. And I think there's a lot of young teachers out now. There's a lot of good teachers around now, for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of young teachers know to get a track man or something, and they think, okay, that's all there is to it. It's not, there's a lot of instinct. I mean, some of the older teachers way back when, you know, even the players, they didn't have all this information. I mean, Jack Nicklaus didn't grow up with all, you know, all the stuff that we've got today. And you know, even Tiger, he uses it in a way that enables him to understand what he's trying to do. And I think obviously for club fitting and stuff, it's really good where you look at a club and, as you know, you get a driver out or you try a different shaft and you say, well, this one's spinning way less, and so, well, the launch is way higher. And so, I mean, that's big advantages. So, yeah, technology is great as long as it's used in the right way.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, especially with Sportsbox AI, the 3D data, you know, that you can get really, really technical with that. But I always felt like, you know, people always said I was a really technical player. I didn't really think so. No. For me, I use technology and I used, I guess, technical forms to just marry what I'm feeling and what I'm actually doing. That's what I just wanted to make sure I was doing every single time. And I think that's why 3D data is so, it's really cool to use.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you take Sportsbox. I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, that you can actually turn a 2D into 3D, which is, I mean, for people out there, it's like you should check in the Sportsbox, because it really is fascinating where, you know, just from a regular video, you've now got a 3D, an avatar, then you can actually, yeah, and you can actually measure. You've got certain measurements. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're trying to get a little bit more of a shoulder turn, or and working with a coach is obviously probably the ideal thing to do, just trying to figure it out yourself, because this game can drive you nuts.
Oh, 100%. I tried looking at 3D avatar, and I was like, gee, hey, I don't know any of these numbers. but yeah, I think working with your coach is really important, but it's also honing in. And like you said before, like for me, when I played, I hated being under the plane. That was like the number one thing that we've always worked on ever since I was 14. I hate that feeling of being under the plane. So to tie into our next section, we're going to do a little fun this or that. So when you were coaching players, or let's say you're coaching just an amateur golfer that you're seeing for the first time, we're going to ask you, which would you rather see? Would you rather see a golfer be laid off at the top or way across the line?
Well, I mean, you look at Bobby Jones. I mean, he was way across the line, right? And you got players who, like a Lee Trevino, was way laid off. So, I mean, you can play successful golf from both positions. So I would say for the average amateur, though, to get it slightly across the line would be more preferable. Okay. And so because it enables them to sort of help to drop the club on the inside. I mean, you think of most players, good players, yeah, they don't want it under the plane. They don't want to be stuck. They don't want to be swinging too far from in to out. But, I mean, the average golfer who's the exact opposite, I mean, that's a dream position for them to be able to hit a push draw, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I would say that the average golfer, to have it slightly across. Remember, also, laid off is just a term. It's almost as if a club is short and parallel, it should look slightly for a right-hander, slightly to the left as it gets longer. Because remember, when you were swinging it really short, say with the US Open time, your club did look laid off. Mm-hmm. But as your club gets longer, I mean, you know, I've seen you where you had the club across the line. So it's almost like as it completes the circle, it gets a little bit more across. Because the swing, as much as people say it is, it's not a perfect circle. It's not. So it's an image, but that it works well. But in fact, so I would say, I would say across.
Okay. And then I think you answered this already, but would you rather see someone be over the plane or under the plane?
Well, as I say, I think if you're a higher handicap, I'd rather see him under the plane. Uh-huh. I think a good player would be above the plane, but parallel to it. Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. I mean, you know, players who slice, they are above the plane, but they're steep and above the plane. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at, you go some players who the person you imitate very well, Miguel Ángel Jiménez. I always like to say that name. It sounds like you've got a really bad cold, you know. But you know, who actually, I mean, as he takes it back, I mean, he gets it really around him, and then he comes out and over the top. But the path is, you know, the hands and everything are moving out, but it's still parallel to the plane. That's the interesting thing. So, you know, whether you get it up like a Jim Furyk and then work it that way, or you get that. I mean, those, talk about two extremes. I mean, Miguel Ángel Jiménez. I love saying that name all the time. And then, obviously, it's a completely different swing from Jim, you know.
Okay, last one. Would you rather see an amateur have an open stance or a closed stance?
I think more of an open stance with the shorter clubs and more of a closed stance with the longer clubs. So somewhere in between. Generally speaking, I mean, it's, you know, you can actually, whoops, sorry, thanks. I need directions on this mic. Mic behave. Okay, right. So I think that, you know, believe it or not, you can actually draw the ball quite easily standing open. Everybody says, okay, you've got to be closed. Okay, well, a lot of times, you know, players, you go back to way back, Sam Snead, he used to be aiming right and then take it in, and then actually, he used to actually work over the top. So he actually hit a fade standing closed. Now, other players, I mean, Lee Trevino, he tended to hit a fade, but as he got older, he lost distance, so he started to hit a draw from an open stance. So it's, you know, so it's the feet, and people, you know, you look at openness. Is it the feet? Is it the hips? Is it the shoulders? Because the feet don't make a whole lot of difference. It's more of a visual than anything else. But I would say, generally speaking, say the longer clubs, maybe say slightly closed, and as you get down to the short arm, slightly open.
And why is that? Why longer, close?
Well, because it's sort of, you know, a lot of times that visual of the feet being slightly closed gives you the sense of a more of an in-to-out path. Mm-hmm. The shorter, when you've got shorter irons, like, you know, if a wedge, for instance, you can stand slightly open, right? Uh-huh. So it just gives you a chance to sort of clear out of the way and keep the club face on line longer through impact.
Dad, when it comes to teaching and your teaching philosophy, is there anything that you thought and then maybe a couple months or years later you're like, oh no, that's wrong? Is there anything that you like completely changed your mind about?
I couldn't say that on TV, could I? But they'd say, well, listen, what's he talking about? You know, all those lessons I took, what a waste of money. Well, I want my money back.
You know, I mean, I go back to just seeing you growing up in your office, you know, drawing things and making training aids and all kinds of stuff. Was there anything, or maybe there's even just like an epiphany that you had about the golf swing that you're like, oh man, like this is it. This is going to help so many people, and I got it.
I mean, apart from my new training aid I'm bringing out now, you mean?
Yes, yeah, yes, right, the right, new right. training aid.
Which will
that.
Help thousands
Wait,
of golfers.
Do explain.
No, I showed it to you last
one that
time.
When you had COVID.
Yeah, when I had COVID, I showed it to you. You probably thought, well, he's on drugs.
There's
anyway,
a new training aid coming out, guys. It's very exciting.
Called the Straightaway. Yeah, it's going to be really cool. But anyway, you know what? I wrote a book in 1989 called The Golf Swing, and we used David Frost as the model. Okay, mm-hmm. And so that book is still pretty much the basis of mine and our academies, because you've got 36 academies around the world, you know, in conjunction with a company called Golf Zone, which is the biggest simulator company in the world. So we've got all these academies. We've got 100-odd coaches, and that's still the basis of our instruction. And I remember when I wrote that book, it was interesting because, I don't know if you remember, Centinela Hospital, okay, in L.A., yeah, they used to go on the men's tour and the women's tour. They were the fitness component out there. And they came to me after that book came out, and they said to me, where did you get your information? I remember when Kelly was on tour.
Kelly's my mom.
Yeah, they did tests on all the girls. Well, I had to show this. How they stuck needles in them to check how the muscles were firing and what have you. It was quite painful, but now they've just got, obviously, markers you stick on them. But they did all this testing from a biomechanical standpoint. They said, well, it's amazing. I said, well, it was just sort of stuff that I've come up with, and you know, my personal research and feedback from all these good players, et cetera, my reading. Because, you know, I'm an avid reader of instruction going way back. I've got a collection of books going back to the 19th century from instruction. I mean, it's just something that you look at, and it's like some things have changed a lot, obviously, because of equipment from hickory to steel and so on. But it's been very interesting. But anyway, they getting back to that story, they said, it's amazing how your book, we could have written that book because it tallies so closely to what we've discovered, which, you know, was quite a compliment at the time. And so I haven't really deviated a lot. So my philosophy is also, I might say things in different ways. I mean, you know, that's you do that naturally. I mean, you sort of have a patter but I do think, I'd say, I mean, I look at golf. Now, instruction is still, it's quite complicated in many ways. I mean, the average amateur doesn't have the time to play and to practice. I mean, they've got less time now than they did in years gone by, right? I mean, you've got, you know, with cell phones and what have you, I mean, you've got to get back in 30 seconds to somebody, where in the old days, it's like, you know, you call them back the next day on your answering, you know, an answering machine. And so people don't have a lot of time to play and practice. So people want it now. And I just think that, say, this new, I mean, more excited about this training than I've brought out a lot over the years, but this one is going to help people to get the correct takeaway. And because to me, the first move in the swing is the most important move. And if you look at all the pros, they all have a certain look. Some of them maybe a little further away from them, like a Dustin Johnson, for instance. Some of them a little closer, like Tiger. But they always have that look where the hands are in and the club head is out. And what this little unit does, you clip it on your club, and it'll give you an exact position where you want to be to take the club away. And mm-hmm. and after doing a few of them, you get into the repetition of things, and I think it's going to help. To me, it's going to make teaching easier, and I'm excited because we've done a lot of testing with tour players. I mean, they love it because it's like it gives them a visual. You know, I mean, you are very visual. You see things, and we did mm-hmm. drills and put the shafts down and stuff. But this is really cool. So it's the, you know, John Daly used to say, "Grip it and rip it." Well, this one's clip it and rip it.
Ha ha! I get it. No, jokes. But that was like my biggest thing. I mean, I think the takeaway is extremely important because it's the beginning step to your swing. And if you do the takeaway wrong, you're just from there trying to fix it. Mm. Whereas if you have a good takeaway, you're just kind of on the right track, you know. And when I used to play bad, my hand would—I mean, we would always work on this. I remember you would always put a club that would point from my right toe, if you're a righty, a right toe going to my left heel.
Yeah.
And then when you take it away, your club should be parallel.
Same angle.
And when I would play bad, and I see a lot of amateurs, every amateur does this, they flip the club where the club just goes, opens and passes their hands in their takeaway.
Gets behind their hands, right.
And then where do you go from there? You go whoop over the top and over the top on the way down. And they, you know, slice it, or they just pull hook it.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, I was telling Hallie earlier that I've been coaching Johnny for the last, you know, however many years. And
is he getting better?
He is. I do have a question for you about his golf swing, which I think a lot of our listeners can also learn from. But yeah, his takeaway, we've been working on that because he kind of flips it this way. And his main thing is keeping his lag. And I feel like, this is coach to coach here, I feel like he is
just a little coaching
yeah,
moment.
Yeah, coaching moment right here. Coach to coach, we can talk about this. But I feel like as his coach that he loses his lag because he doesn't give proper lag. I mean, he doesn't properly create the lag in the beginning. Mm. Because his takeaway, he kind of lifts his hands up and his clubs go this way. So he already has zero lag. So then he goes like this, and he throws his hand backwards at the top, and then he comes in and he loses his
casting.
Lag.
Oh no!
He casts.
So how is your relationship? Is it pretty good? I mean, is he actually paying for this information or?
No, he said
does
I.
He listen. Does he listen well?
No, he said I ruined his golf game.
Oh,
but
no,
you know,
no, no.
Well, no gonna, but I have. We have a
first,
much better.
First, you're on the list. You're going to get this straight away, and it will.
Yes.
It will straight away help him.
Exactly. Okay. Straight away, clip it and rip it.
Yeah.
But I do want to ask you a question, coach to coach again. How does one help maintain their lag on their downswing? Because I feel like I can't, it's so hard for me to teach that because I've always had really...
You've had tremendous lag.
Yeah, and it's, we've worked at times to get rid of some of my lag,
yeah,
you know? So
yeah.
It's hard for me to teach creating lag.
You could sell that for a lot of money, that lag, you know that.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I feel like a lot of our listeners... I see a lot of amateur golfers.
Well,
say,
you know,
you know.
It's interesting you say that because, to me, it's funny that so much of what you see in the swing you can trace back to the takeaway. Mm-hmm. If you've got something going on here, you're going to probably have something going on there. Mm-hmm. Because it's interesting how the takeaway is somewhat similar to the movement coming back into the ball when you spoke about the club, the stick, you know, uh-huh. between your, you know, between your left toe and your right heel. Well, I mean, the thing is, when you in doing that, sorry, other way.
The right, other
sorry,
way, yeah,
sorry,
yeah.
I'm thinking about Harry. Okay. Lefty and her brother, James. But anyway, so, yeah, because that image is really important coming back mm-hmm. down into it. So if I think if players get the right takeaway, just literally work on half swings, and then remember how your body works is so absolutely essential. I mean, you had such a great change of direction. I mean, you had unbelievable lag. I've never seen lag. I mean, that's why you hit the ball so far. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you struck your iron so well. That's why you hit so high. You know, I mean, you got that spin on it. But so if players would actually work on their takeaway and really not swing it back more than past, say, 9 o'clock where their left arm is, and then just as they move forward, they can actually almost add angle to the mm-hmm. wrist action. Because the problem is, it's like you're, you know, the golf swing is a synchronized movement between your arms and your body. If you've got all this sort of jazz going on early, it's almost as if you have to almost intentionally throw the club to catch up. Mm-hmm. So just trying to add lag in from a mess that's happened before, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. It's a chain reaction, it's a sequence of motion. So that start, to me, as I say, when I look at a golfer now, especially an amateur, I'm working with this straightaway over the last year or two. Sorry, here we go. We'll get there. Don't worry about it. At the end of this show, I will have this right next to my mouth, I promise you. But it's like if I look at the setup, okay, make sure their grip's decent and there's not too much tension in the arms, make sure their posture, they've got good posture, and then get a good start. And that takeaway is only a very short movement. Literally, the butt of the club moves about a foot and the head moves about 3 feet. It's not like you have to sort of extend it way yeah. back or that. So that first move, I'm telling you, it's such a key. It's, you know, I mean, if you don't get a good start, how are you going to have a good ending, you know? I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
And so I think that, so that little lag action where you just from halfway back, I mean, because you can hit it solid that way. I mean, really start to strike it purely. And so I remember, you know, Jeff Ogilvie, Australian player, I mean, he'd work on his wedges, because he felt that he could actually create the right technique with wedges, and then he'd work on his driver. You go to the range with two clubs. Yeah. You know, so it was quite interesting.
Okay, I'm going to steal that.
Mm.
All right, yeah, Johnny, hope you're listening to that.
Yeah.
Dad, I want to switch gears.
Don't worry, I'll certify her, Johnny. We'll get it on the right track.
He's a certified Ledbetter instructor.
Yeah.
Dad, want to switch gears here quickly. Question for you. Michelle and I have talked about this before. I am always really amazed at your ability to deal with the haters, as we call them. I mean, I'll see people say things like lead poisoning on social media, and people will say, oh, David Ledbetter ruined so-and-so's golf swing or whatnot. And, you know, Michelle and I will talk about it, and I'll go to war in the comments with people. And ultimately, like, it doesn't do any good. Like, people are going to think what they think. You've coached players to 23 major championships. I mean, there's nothing to prove. You're obviously an incredibly talented, amazing golf instructor. I just don't understand where people get this, and I'm just continually amazed at your ability to just say water off a duck's back. So I'm curious, does it actually ever bother you when people say stupid, ignorant stuff about you, or do you genuinely just go, whatever, I don't care?
I'm like a rhinoceros owl.
Okay.
Okay. I'm thick-skinned and I charge a lot. Okay. So, but no. But look, I mean, I don't really read that all that social media stuff. I mean, Michelle, she obviously knows. I mean, through the tough times and the great times. I mean, you know, people are people. It's just human nature. Unfortunately, they have a platform now, you know, on social media to sort of either they're probably frustrated at home or something's not going right with their lives and they feel like they should lash out, and whether it's jealousy, whether it's, I don't know, it's some people just have that sort of knack about being not positive. And so, listen, all you can do is your best. As long as you're happy with what you're doing and the people around you are happy, your family and the people that you care about, I mean, that's all that counts. I mean, you can't be all things to all people. There's just no way. And it's just, unfortunately, it's just in this world, it's like you just look at all the negativity and, you know, and I feel like, hey, I've had a pretty good career. I've had some success, and I mean, hey, could I've done better in a certain time? Sure, probably. Yeah, I mean, who couldn't? I mean, we could all look back and say, hey, I should have done this better. I should have done that better. But at the time, you know, I mean, it's like I just personally feel, look, if you could always put a positive spin on things and say nice things about people, I mean, I don't think it makes you feel any better by sort of razzing on people and saying this or that. And it's just, I mean, you just think that, what is this person's problem? Why? So in the end, it's like, look, you just got to make the people that you're close to and the people happy and do the best job you can do. And I say, if some people like it, some people don't. Just the way it is, right? I mean, it's like some people like white, some people like black. You know, some people like Mercedes, some people like BMW. I mean, it's just the way it is, right? So, I mean, it's... And so now it's never really bothered me to any extent. I mean, as I think if you sit and read all that stuff and you can, if you believe all the good stuff, you know, you can go a little nutty too, as far as, you know, you think, well, you're better than you are. But,
yeah. It's like if you give anybody the power to make you feel good about yourself, you also give them the power to make you feel bad about yourself.
Yeah,
too,
no, so. Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. So anyway, it is what it is. And I think if you become somewhat prominent in whatever line of work or business you're in, whether it be a player or a coach or whatever, you know, you're there to be shot at. It's just comes with the territory.
Well, that's what you always told me when I call you crying because someone calls me fat on Instagram or something. You're like, listen, if people are saying, you know, are trying to tear you down, it probably means that you're onto something good.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, we've got a couple more questions here for you. Five questions presented by Five Iron Golf. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm. If it was called Six Iron, there'd be six questions, is that right?
Yes, exactly. But it's just five.
Okay, just five. Okay.
Michelle, you kick it off.
First question. Who was your favorite student besides us, obviously?
Favorite? Oh, geez, I don't know. You know, people always ask me that. I say, you know, I always get into trouble because it's like, I said somebody at some stage and somebody else said, why don't you say me?
Favorite.
I can say it.
Okay, all right, never mind. Sorry.
Just because you've been a really good friend of mine, and I mean, we were sort of knew each other when we were really young, Nick Price, probably, just through the fact that, hey, you know, he's a good guy. I spoke to him this morning. He said, oh, hey, say hi to Hallie and Michelle. So, anyway, we're building a golf course together.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's going to be pretty awesome with it. Amazing practice facility and stuff. So with no mats, by the way.
No mats. Okay, good.
Oh, wait, that just reminded me. Michelle and I in the intro were recounting that time that you made somebody eat wasabi and told him it was guacamole. Was that Nick Price?
That was a guy. Actually, he worked for me, and then he actually became Seri Pass coach, Tom Creevy.
Next question. Most difficult student you ever taught besides Michelle?
Excuse me.
To be honest, if a person was difficult, we never sort of lost it. I mean, not that I lost that many students. I mean, I had people after a period of time where they wanted to do something different or whatever, you know. I mean, that comes with the territory. But most difficult, I mean, I think if they come to see you, you know, they sort of realize that you've got some sort of credibility and they're not likely to be sort of, you know what, people have sort of, they have a certain amount of decorum about them and they polite and they might be, you know, I mean, yeah, it was a guy, his name was Howard Clark. Really good player, Ryder Cup player and so on and so forth. Really good ball striker, and he was the nicest guy off the golf course. But you get him on the golf course, the guy was like just a terror. I mean, he was like, oh, he gets so angry. And I mean, I remember one time, I was on a European tour event, and one of the other players that I worked with just came up to say hi and say, hey, listen, when you finished with Howard, would you mind you come in, have a look at me? And he just ripped him a new one, saying, what, hey, this is my time. Don't step into my office, okay? And it was like, I said, whoa, you know, so it was like, okay. So the guy went, all right, sorry. I mean, even here, I found it quite pleasant, really, because we went to dinner. I mean, you know, people are funny. Golf does funny things to people, right? I mean, it changes their moods, changes their attitudes, and, you know, they can be just absolutely, I mean, it's like, we take Nick Faldo, Sir Nick Faldo, so I have to call him Sir Nick now. He I mean, around golf, I mean, he was not Mr. Popular. I mean, but that was the way he actually played his best golf, because he was so, I wouldn't say self-centered, but he was so focused on what he was doing. Nobody else existed. And so he wasn't Mr. Pleasant. He wasn't pleasant to the spectators or anything. But yet you get him away, go to dinner. He was funny. He was like jovial. So golf does strange things to people, you know, because it puts you under a lot of pressure, golf.
Most bizarre teaching story.
Most bizarre?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Jordan Belfort, yeah. Okay, Wolf of Wall Street, yeah. Yeah, he was bizarre. It was F every second word, you know. And so, I mean, what you saw in the movie was pretty much Jordan Belfort. I mean, he was a strong, stocky guy who loved golf. I mean, you know, yes, golf was in his movie. And he came down a few times to see us in Florida, and with his cohort, who I think also ended up in jail. But anyway, I just said to him, "Hey, look, you know, just think of it this way: you can practice your short game a lot more in there, you know." So, which he needed to. But so that was somewhat bizarre. But Sylvester Stallone, Ray Romano, I mean, I won't say bizarre, but they're just interesting, because they're just interesting people, how they've been successful. You know, I remember Sylvester Stallone. I mean, you know, he's built, as we know. I mean, he wasn't as tall as he looked on Rocky, but he was very well built and the worst slicer, you know. And funny enough, so one of the celebrities that I worked with was Derek Jeter. Now, Derek Jeter was obviously one of the premier batters in the history of baseball, you know, and you know, the worst slicer you've ever seen. Consequently, he actually never played golf when he was, hardly ever, when he was actually playing, because he didn't want it to affect his batting swing, you know. Okay. So it was interesting. That was bizarre to see a player who literally had all the talent in the world to hit a baseball, but yet, you know, just, you know, I mean, I haven't seen him for a while, so I'm not sure how his game has progressed, but at that stage, it was like, you know, it would be, you know, he hit it about 350, I suppose, but about, you know, 150 this way, and then 200 that way, you know. So it was like, so when you added it all up, it was 350. But bizarre.
What is the biggest mistake you see amateurs make?
Well, I would say probably the biggest fault is their grip. The fact that most amateurs have a very poor grip. You know, if they wear a whole lot in their glove, you know, they've got a bad grip. So I would suggest that most players sort of grip the club more down towards the fingers, because it allows them to get the club set correctly. You know, if you get it too high in the palm, it really creates probably a bad takeaway. You know, you've seen that yourself, huh? So it's that's one thing I would say, that you know, the takeaway, I mean, is a result a lot of times of bad posture, bad grip. So, yeah, I mean, I think if amateurs could get, I mean, as I said earlier, I mean, if amateurs could get a good grip, good posture, and a good start, and then, you know, the rest is not that difficult. It's just getting there, just getting ready. And we know in golf, the problem is the ball still. So you're standing over the ball. I mean, interesting now, I know you did it for a while too. I can't remember which swing it was, but you did it for sure. But, you know, how these players are rehearsing their takeaways now, right? You see them. So Justin Thomas and Xander Schauffele. I mean, they have this almost mini, that's their wag. It's what I call the modern waggle now. In the old days, you know, you used to get people sort of doing this sort of thing, but now it's like it's almost rehearsing that waggle. So amateurs can do that and sort of probably get off to a better start.
Okay, last question for you. Have you ever given a lesson and come across an amateur golfer that was so bad? It could be amateur or pro. A golfer that was so bad, so bad, that you either walked off or at the end of the lesson you're like, no, can't help you.
Yeah, I've had a couple. I mean, look, fortunately, I've been, over the last few years, I haven't sort of had to do that, and I've sort of, you know, designated them to, you know, people who might be suspect, to one of my sort of assistants, right? So, yeah, especially if somebody's shanking or something. Oh my God, here we go, because you know it's that's the worst thing. You get somebody to stop shanking, and they shank the last one. Well, just let's hit a couple more, and they're still shanking. It's like so. You know, it becomes contagious. But, yeah, I mean, listen, there are some people who golf, it's not suited to them. I mean, it really isn't. You know, you just say, listen, mate, you know, tennis may be a better option, you know, because you've got two serves and you've got a heck of a lot bigger surface to make contact with. So, but I think generally speaking, I mean, if you've got some sort of athleticism about you, that anybody can, you know, you can get somebody to hit a ball. I mean, even, I mean, just you look at all these top golf facilities now. I mean, you know, what, 60% of those people never play golf. I mean, they just got in, just whack it, you know, and it's like it's see how far they can hit, see if they can, you know, score a few points. And it's a fun thing, right? I mean, and so I think that, I mean, I've had, you know, I've had people who, I mean, especially I also remember, a you know, corporate clinics. I did a clinic one time at the Tour Championship in Atlanta, and it was, I think, Coca-Cola were bringing some of their clients in, you know. And we had, what was his name? Andres Romero. Okay, he actually nearly won the Open when Harrington won it, and Sergio should have won it. Andres Romero, yeah, he's a really, really good young player, and I didn't speak much English. I mean, they had this guy. He was from India, as it happened, and he played a lot of cricket, you know, so his feet were, you know, in cricket, you move your feet all over the place, you know. So I saw this guy, and so what happened, they had myself and a couple other instructors, coaches, and so we would sort of help the pros would sort of, you know, and I said to Anders, I said, hey, go help this guy. You see, so I'm watching, I said, I wonder what the heck's he going to do with this guy, because literally the guy was sort of, you know, I mean, his feet were moving all over the place, and he was, you know, he thought it was a cricket bat, you know. And so after two shots, he said, you shit, and he walked off. So I don't know how that worked out for customer relations, but anyway, it's like, that was it. And, you know, we were just packing up laughing, so anyway, that was like.
Oh, man, the story's so
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, there are a lot of stories, ones I probably can't even remember now, that happened and you laugh. And, you know, it's because for most people, golf's meant to be fun, right? I mean, look, when you get on tour, it's not so much fun. I mean, it's like, I mean, you didn't play a whole lot of fun golf because, I mean, you were tired and you were, I mean, it's not like you went out and, I mean, some it's amazing how some players love it so much. They're playing, what, I mean, Max Homa, after he won at, where did he win, San Diego or something, he was playing on a Muni 2 days later with some friends, you know. Not everybody loves the game that much that they do that. I mean, a lot of people think of it as a job. You know, I always remember that Boo Week. He says, oh, I hate golf, but I'm good at it, so I play, you know, and I make a living out of it. So, which is sad, really. I mean, I know, you know, I mean, probably all the golf that you played there, Michelle, that you, sometimes you got tired of it, you know. I mean, it was like, okay, I've got to do this. I'm good at it. I've got, you know, I mean, this is the way I make a living, so I go and play. But, I mean, the last thing you want to do when you take a week or two off is to go back and, okay, go and play with, you know, friends at times. I mean, you did it at times, but, I mean, for the most part, you know, hey, I'm just resting here because, I mean, it's a long old slog out there on tour. I mean, a lot of, you know, it's very tiring and all the commitments you had with, you know, all the media and everything else. So it's like it's a hard balance. But fortunately, as I say, for most golfers out there, it's fun. And if we can, as coaches, we can just get them to play a little bit better. They have more fun and they enjoy it more. So that's what it's all about.
If you have not been to a 5-iron golf yet, you have to go, you guys. It's an awesome place. You can golf, practice, and party. It's basically a high-tech, inclusive urban golf experience designed for golfers and non-golfers with 14 locations across 9 cities. Oh, wait. With 20 locations across 9 cities, 5-iron golf is great for date night, quality time with 5-iron golf is great for date night, quality times with your friends or your parents, or the best happy hour a corporate work event has ever seen. I've been to quite a few. Trust me, they are so fun. So make sure you guys check out 5-iron, and Golf Mostly listeners get an exclusive discount. Mention Golf Mostly at checkout to get 25% off your next sim rental booking. All right, Dad. Well, thank you so much for stopping by.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. I didn't have much choice.
You begged us to come on the podcast.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, that's right. I did. And so that's great to see you guys. Man, you do a good job. I love listening to you. And you have had some stellar celebrities here. So it's, I mean, Golf Mostly. Right. I was. Why did I say mostly golf?
It's okay. We'll
golf Mostly. I think it's a great name, and you got, you know, it's interesting because golf does lends itself to a lot of different things in life, you know, and the people that, I mean, just think of the athletes and Steph Currys and stuff that love to play, right? I mean, it's just amazing.
Awesome.
I mean.
Yeah. Awesome. Dad, thank you so much for coming. Really appreciate it. And maybe I know you're in town for a couple of days, so maybe we can get a tune up.
There we go.